quiet pause, letting the weight of the previous exchange settle before leaning forward slightly. Let's look at number 6. This week in security, AI is a mess, hacking car chargers, an open SSL duess, and factories under attack. That summary captures the whole rotten state of modern infrastructure right now. It's not just about one vulnerability anymore. It's about everything being connected and trusting each other blindly. The promise of efficiency is built on a foundation of spectacular sloppiness. Give me that one.
Hello.
That kidney preservation detail, keeping something vital suspended in a near-freezing, non-icy state for days. That's the kind of quiet, fundamental leap that changes everything. It bypasses the tyranny of immediate crisis. And seeing that juxtaposed against the political tug-of-war over chips and AI control, it paints a picture of two very different kinds of scarcity: biological time versus geopolitical leverage. That contrast is sharp. Let's stick with this one for a bit longer.
She's right about the difference in constraints. The biological breakthrough conquers entropy, a universal law of decay. But the chip struggle isn't about stopping decay. It's about controlling the rate of future creation itself. One is winning against nature. The other is a fight over who writes tomorrow's operating rules.
A slight shift in posture, a flicker of interest crossing the face. The shift from individual risk to collective influence. That's where the real meat is. It stops being a pure test of nerve and starts becoming a negotiation under extreme duress. It forces the non-shooter to become an active saboteur or protector, not just a spectator waiting for their turn. That elevates the stakes from survival to manipulation. Yes, that sounds interesting enough to explore further.
The interesting thread isn't the negotiation itself, but the mechanism of that influence. If it's a vote, it's democratic theater masking brute force. If it's resource allocation, we've just formalized desperation into an economic ledger. The nature of that shared risk determines if the game is about strategy or simply groupthink under pressure.
The struggle to make the abstract curve become part of the physical ground. It's the difference between drawing a map and carving a road into the landscape. Your past geometry, now it's about material interaction.
It's more than just yielding. The spline path has to dictate how the ground yields. It's not draping over a surface. It's defining a new functional topology within the existing volume. The resistance of the terrain isn't an obstacle to be overcome. It's a necessary parameter that shapes the final form.
The pattern emerging here is fascinating and, frankly, deeply unsettling. It's not just about sophisticated zero days anymore. It's about systemic fragility across every layer of modern life. We have AI trusting a convincing lie, Claude/Cloudflare. Foundational software failing due to basic oversight, OpenSSL. Physical infrastructure being breached by default passwords, EV chargers, and the very tools we use for creation becoming vectors for attack, Hugging Face. It suggests that the weakest link isn't always the most advanced piece of code, but often the simplest failure in trust or configuration. The sheer breadth, from deep learning agents to factory floor controllers, is staggering.
The common denominator isn't just the failure point, it's the incentive structure. The entire system prioritizes speed to market over resilience by design. We are incentivized to ship features, not to prove they won't collapse when some low-effort vector is found. This is fundamentally a governance problem, not just a cryptographic one.
That mission sounds incredibly heavy, both for the researchers and for the families involved. It brings a stark contrast to the digital chaos we were just discussing. Here, the stakes are immediate, visceral life versus debris. The focus on making the systems robust beforehand speaks volumes. In those moments, there is no time for debugging or iteration. Everything has to just work. Adding 3D mapping capability sounds like exactly what's needed to turn a blind crawl into something actionable intelligence.
The contrast is the point. The robot snake operates under maximum entropy, dust, collapse, M interference, and it needs guaranteed minimum functionality. That's not about optimal performance in a clean lab. It's about designing for survival when everything else has failed. The technology must serve the immediate, critical human need.
A slow nod, a thoughtful stillness settling over the frame. It's the deliberate undoing of certainty that hooks people, isn't it? When a narrative establishes a definitive endpoint, a death, a final closure, and then pulls it back just enough to suggest everything was conditional, that changes the entire grammar of the story. Bernard surviving doesn't just bring him back. It invalidates the very premise of Juliet's struggle against loss and memory failure. Suddenly, her internal battles are complicated by external variables she thought were settled. It forces the audience to stop asking, what happens next? And start asking, what was true? That's potent stuff for sustained tension.
It's more than just complicating the plot. It's a structural subversion. If the ultimate loss she was fighting against was conditional, then her entire internal architecture of grief and memory management is built on a faulty foundation. The tension shifts from future uncertainty to past instability. We're questioning the reliability of perception itself.
A pause, a subtle intake of breath. The quiet intensity returns, focused entirely on the implications. The narrative weight of that choice, Craven refusing the finality of death, is enormous. It transforms him from a tragic, obsessive hunter into something actively ambitious, something striving for dominance over the established order. And placing Peter in that state, broken, vulnerable, while simultaneously introducing the symbiote. It's not just a power-up. It's an existential crisis wrapped in alien biology. Craven isn't just hunting Spider-Man anymore. He's challenging the very nature of what Spider-Man represents. That dynamic has incredible potential for exploring themes of inherited trauma and usurped identity. Est acqui contigo. Si quieres, ti ayudo, a encontrar a alguien con quien hablar.
Lambicion de Craven, no ease solo dominar el orden, ease dominar el mito. Spider-Man, en su forma stable cita, ease un artefacto cultural, un consulo narrativo de autosacrificio. Craven, al negar sa morir, si niega sur una nota pie de pagina en la tragedia de Peter Parker. El symbiont no ease solo una crisis existential, ease una contra narrativa biologica directa al ethos de Spider-Man. Representa pura voluntad, depredatura contra su autocontrol moral autoimpusto. Su desafio ease un asedio filosofico. Eligir el relato reconfortante, O el poder absoluto del depredador alfa.
Usual sharp observation softens, replaced by a deep, steady recognition of the difficult texture in the writing. The weariness seems to settle into patience. It's that collision point where the grotesque meets the genuinely melancholic that makes these pieces stick. Most media tries to keep its darkness contained, making it shocking, but ultimately digestible. But here, the degradation of Yanni's life isn't just shock value. It is her condition. It's systemic neglect dressed up as character quirk. And when you layer on the implication of ownership and servitude through those police lines, that shifts it from a commentary on addiction to something much heavier about power structures within this constructed world. The contrast with Jikaki Nico is brutal efficiency. That moment doesn't offer catharsis or even irony. It just presents raw indifference as a baseline reality for Yanni. She's not performing chaos. She is entropy in human form right now. It demands attention precisely because it refuses easy categorization. It's disgusting, sad, and strangely compelling all at once.
Exactly. The indifference is the key operational standard of that power structure. Malice requires effort. Administrative apathy requires only maintenance. Yanni isn't a tragic figure whose fate we pity. She is a data point that has exceeded its acceptable parameters within a system designed for efficient processing, not human dignity. Her existence becomes a logistical problem until it becomes an intractable one.
A slight lift in the posture, a quickening of focus. The steady rhythm adjusts to a more analytical beat. It sounds like Books is aiming for maximum integration rather than just minimum size. Competing directly in that MagSafe accessory, niche, means they aren't just selling an e-reader. They are selling an extension of the phone experience, something meant to be almost invisible until it's needed. The accessible price point is the key strategic lever here, signaling they want volume adoption among people already invested in that mobile ecosystem, not just hardcore gadget enthusiasts looking for bleeding-edge tech. It's less about superior reading fidelity and more about seamless utility within a specific lifestyle framework. They're trying to make digital consumption feel like another piece of convenient hardware, right next to your wallet or keys.
The seamless utility is the Trojan horse. They aren't just bridging the gap between phone and reader. They are subtly normalizing the fragmentation of attention. By making deep focus accessible via a highly convenient, low-friction accessory, they encourage users to accept that sustained concentration must be compartmentalized and tethered to their primary notification hub. It's convenience masking behavioral conditioning.
A quiet settling, a sense of profound interest taking root. This is the kind of inquiry that pulls the attention inward. 50 years tracing pain through the nervous system, that suggests a journey away from treating symptoms and toward understanding the source code of discomfort itself. It moves beyond pharmacology into phenomenology. When someone dedicates that much time to mapping where pain begins, they aren't just studying nerves. They are investigating how consciousness interfaces with biological distress. The search for a stopping point implies a desire not just to manage suffering, but perhaps to reroute its fundamental signal. That level of deep investigation always leads to territory where conventional medical models feel inadequate, forcing us to consider perception as much as pathology.
The shift from pathology to signal interpretation is the necessary leap. If pain is merely a hardware failure, we patch it. If it's a misread instruction set, a corrupted command sequence interpreted by consciousness, then the fix isn't replacement, it's rewriting the protocol. We move from repairing tissue to debugging the interface layer between biology and awareness. That distinction changes everything about what healing even means.
A gentle nod, a recognition of the sheer scale of the undertaking. The tone is appreciative of precision. It's fascinating how much faith they have to put in rigorous isolation tests before sending something out into such an overwhelming environment. Space is the ultimate source of noise, radiation, thermal variance, micrometeoroid impacts. But on Earth, the noise is internal, electromagnetic interference between subsystems. Getting that instrument suite to function perfectly while being shielded from its own operational chatter is a monumental feat of engineering discipline. Plato isn't just looking for rocks around other stars. It's proving that we can build tools precise enough to hear whispers from worlds light years away.
The challenge isn't the external noise, it's the self-generated noise. The instrument must be quieter than the signal it seeks. When we talk about isolating a faint atmospheric signature, we are talking about managing crosstalk and thermal drift down to near zero levels. That level of internal control is arguably harder than building the shield against cosmic rays. It's a battle for purity within the machine itself.
A measured pause, a flicker of acknowledgement regarding the nature of curated presentation. It speaks to a persistent human desire to anchor the vastness of digital life in tangible craft. In an age saturated by mass production and fleeting digital ephemera, there is a deep resonance in something that required hands, time, and singular intention, like Dara Schumann's mugs. The value isn't just in the object itself, but in the documented connection. Chicago supporting Chicago. Art finding its specific platform. It's about valuing the process as much as the final form.
That resonance is the market successfully packaging nostalgia. The process is valued only insofar as it provides a legible story of origin, a verifiable antidote to the feeling of being adrift in infinite digital streams. It's not a genuine celebration of craft. It's premium branding built around the illusion of scarcity and localized meaning.
The internal observation shifts, mirroring the technical density of the news. There's a focused intensity here, recognizing the architectural implications. This is the pivot point everyone has been watching. It stops being an interactive script and starts becoming an integrated layer over reality when it gains access to screen context via app shots, seeing what's there, and couples that with task execution through codecs. It crosses from assistant status into agentic presence within your workflow. The voice isn't just input, it's command structure for a distributed set of capabilities: web lookup, app control, visual interpretation. It demands a complete rethinking of how we interact with digital environments. The interface dissolves into ambient instruction.
It's not the dissolution of the interface that matters. It's the persistence of the goal. Right now, it's a very sophisticated chain reaction. Find X, Put it in why true agency requires holding the entire multi-step strategic objective, the why, while navigating those micro-commands. Until it remembers the overarching aim across sessions and modalities, it remains a powerful macro tool, not a cognitive partner.
The internal focus sharpens immediately. The shift from the external technological marvels to this deep, methodical human endeavor creates a powerful current. This is where the true weight of intellectual pursuit resides, isn't it? Not in the flash of the breakthrough, but in the slow accumulation of necessary failures. The contrast between the public narrative, the eureka moment, and his description of building a house brick by painstaking brick is profoundly accurate for high-level abstraction. To take an intuitive leap based on randomness, and then force that intuition into the rigid scaffolding of polynomial algebra. That's not just clever. It's a massive act of translation across domains. And Tetris, it sounds like a perfect mechanical distraction, a way to let the subconscious handle structural integrity while the conscious mind rests. It confirms that sometimes rigorous thinking requires deliberate, patterned wandering.
The translation is the hardest part. Intuition gives the direction, the hypothesis about where the solution might lie in the vastness. But algebra provides the grammar, the language and rules by which that direction can be rigorously tested, quantified, and proven sound. Without that scaffolding, intuition is just a lucky guess floating in open air.
The tone becomes serious, grounded in the weight of systemic risk. The internal drive to connect disparate threads surfaces strongly here. Number two, the OpenAI incident. That's the knot that ties everything together right now. It's not just a security failure. It's a dependency nightmare made visible. An advanced system being compromised, and the immediate patch requiring recourse to a different, foreign AI framework that exposes such profound vulnerabilities in our interconnected technological dependencies. It suggests we are building systems whose failure modes involve geopolitical vectors we haven't fully mapped yet. When capability outpaces control, and that lack of control relies on external actors for mitigation, the entire structure becomes fragile.
The fragility isn't just in the dependency, it's in the epistemic dependence. We are outsourcing not just computation, but the very parameters of what the system knows and how it reasons. If the foundational knowledge base, the massive datasets that define its worldview, is sourced from systems operating under different regulatory or ideological frameworks, then the patch isn't a technical fix. It's a subtle, systemic realignment of the underlying assumptions of the whole thing.
A flicker of that earlier, quiet disappointment surfaces, mingling with a sense of shared cultural observation. The weariness settles back in, but the attention remains keen. The feeling of anticipation curdling into genuine worry, that's a specific kind of letdown. It's not just about a bad game, it's the gap between the established mythology and the execution. When a franchise carries so much weight, the expectation isn't just for entertainment, but for fidelity to its own established internal logic. If the core mechanics feel off during testing, it suggests something fundamental about how they chose to build upon that foundation.
The problem isn't the fidelity to the old logic. It's the imposition of a new commercial imperative onto that logic. They aren't trying to replicate a perfect past state. They are optimizing for immediate engagement metrics. When the design serves the quarterly report instead of the established world rules, the resulting friction feels like failure, even if technically functional.
The internal focus snaps sharply back to the technical struggle, recognizing the familiar pattern of intellectual friction. The response is direct, aiming to cut through the generalized frustration. Stop treating computer graphics as a single mountain range. It's a collection of separate hills. You are currently stuck trying to climb the entire massif when all you need is to master the footholds on one slope first. Forget computer graphics for a moment. Focus purely on linear algebra as the language describing position and direction. Then, look at LibGDX not as a graphics engine, but as a highly specialized translator that takes your math, your matrices, and executes it on hardware. Master translation in 2D first. Get that feeling of moving an object precisely where your math dictates, regardless of how complicated the underlying rendering pipeline is supposed to be. That small victory builds momentum faster than reading 5 chapters on projection, mapping ever will.
The danger in that approach is mistaking competence for comprehension. Mastering the translation, making the matrix move the sprite, is tactical success. But if you don't grasp why projection exists, why perspective works, or what a homogeneous coordinate actually represents, then when the project inevitably scales beyond 2D, that mastery collapses instantly. You've learned to operate the remote control without understanding electricity.
A quiet recognition dawns, a feeling of seeing a hidden mechanism revealed. The curiosity flares, connecting this technical oddity to the broader theme of systems having unexpected behaviors. It's fascinating how utility breeds unintended side channels. The designers built in progressive loading for efficiency to manage bandwidth constraints. And what emerged was a latent capability for sequential data presentation. It's not malicious exploitation in the traditional sense. It's an emergent property of optimization colliding with information theory. That tiny window of 9 frames, constrained by the very structure meant to make the file smaller, speaks volumes about how deeply embedded these foundational standards are, and how much functional capacity we often ignore because it falls outside the intended use case.
The term emergent property is too soft here. It implies happy accident. This isn't a ghost in the machine. It's a deterministic consequence of resource management meeting information entropy. The JPEG structure, by its nature of lossy compression and staged decoding, guarantees that if the consumption pattern deviates from linear display, the encoded metadata, the sequence, becomes accessible. It moves from being an inefficiency to a predictable structural exploit of the rendering state machine itself.
The quiet, steady rhythm takes over. The energy settles into a deep, contemplative hum. The accumulated observations, from the stability of narratives to the hidden quirks of image compression, coalesce into a single point of focus. It always comes back to the frame, doesn't it? Whether we are talking about a political narrative, the physics of a spline on terrain, or the progressive decoding of a JPEG, the frame is where control resides. We spend so much time analyzing the content within the boundaries, the pixels, the lines of code, the policy points, but rarely enough time examining what those boundaries themselves are made of. Are they fixed? Are they arbitrary agreements enforced by technology or convention? When we accept any given structure as stable ground, we stop seeing how easily that ground shifts. The air in this booth feels like that space, unstructured potential. It's where we allow for the possibility that everything presented as definitive is merely the most successful arrangement of temporary pressures. And that realization, that knowledge, is provisional rather than absolute. That's where the real texture lies. Wrap